From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. I'm Rebecca Ward, filling in for Carol Castiel. Joining me on the program is my colleague, Africa News Tonight anchor, Kim Lewis. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Maren Turner, Executive Director of Freedom Now, a U.S.-based nonprofit, nonpartisan group working to free individual prisoners of conscience. Prior to joining Freedom Now, Ms. Turner was an attorney with the Southern Africa Litigation Center in Johannesburg, where she worked with Southern African jurists on human rights litigation. And she's also worked for the defense of such high-profile international human rights cases as that of former Czech Republic President Václav Havel and Nobel Peace Prize laureate Desmond Tutu. Maren Turner, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you, Kim, for being here as well.
Thanks, Rebecca.
Well, the arrest of prisoners of conscience has been around since the beginning of recorded history, but I don't think people think that much about prisoners of conscience these days being so worldwide. Obviously, Iran comes to mind because of the United States and its disputes with that country. North Korea, very high profile. But there's quite a few, I was surprised to learn, in countries like Uzbekistan and Azerbaijan. So why are these former Soviet states such hot spots?
I would say of all of our work, and we do work globally, so we take cases in countries all over the world. So in essence, we work where there is arbitrary detention, which, as you just pointed out, is certainly a global issue. But in terms of regional, when you really break it down regionally, the former Soviet Union countries is truly a hotspot for arbitrary detention. And the reason for that is during the Soviet Union times, arbitrary detention was just their chief tactic of cracking down on dissent, whether it was taking people out to Siberia or putting people in mental institutions, which is a practice that's been resurrected in recent years in Russia, which is a very worrying trend. And we're seeing it in other countries in the region as well. And many of the governments in Central Asia and in the Caucasus are remnants of the old Soviet system. So this is a tactic that is just business as usual, and they continue to carry it out. We see waves of crackdowns and then waves of where they'd lighten up on it. And really that just has to do with whatever global issues are happening at the time. And if they are releasing political prisoners, it's usually because they want something from Western countries.
Are most prisoners of conscience mostly jailed or harassed for political reasons, or are there other reasons that a certain country might go after someone?
There's usually, every country generally has a red line, but I would say in terms of looking at the patterns, the red lines tend to be fairly similar. It's often journalists, it's human rights defenders, it's political activists, and eventually it's often the lawyers as well. So it's anyone who's vocally critical of the government. And whether that's very specifically aimed at officials in the government or it's more generally about the regime, like, for example, in China, where you have dissidents calling for a change of the Chinese government from the authoritarian state to democracy. But what we see most often is the red line that's generally crossed is where, like, to use an illustration in Azerbaijan, it's where they've gone after the president and his wife. His wife, incidentally, is vice president. So it's where the human rights defenders or the journalists make remarks about high-ranking government officials, particularly the presidents, and also speaking about corruption. That's also a very clear red line.
So with that note, I'm going to turn to Kim Lewis, who is particularly interested in the Africa political situation or landscape.
Yes. Just looking at journalists in Africa, of course, there are many that have been detained. I know you have done a lot of work in Africa. And I just noticed that on your website, you highlighted a Cameroonian journalist who was released. Just how did you all go about getting him released, and what is his life like now?
I think you're speaking about Louis Mejo,
yes.
Who's actually in back-facing charges. Louis Mejo was an interesting case. We started working on Cameroon in 2009, 2010, and we worked on a couple of cases, and Louis Mejo was one of them. And he was particularly noteworthy because he ran one of the very, very few independent newspapers in the country. So the imprisonment of someone like that goes far beyond just the grave human rights violations of that individual, like Mr. Mejo. And and goes to just the rights of the people having access to independent news. So his imprisonment was very far-reaching in its consequences for the population. And he was kept in a prison and held in just deplorable. And this is true in a lot of the countries where we work, but the prisons in Cameroon were particularly bad. So when he was released, it was actually a culmination of a number of different things. We had worked on his case, his legal case, which we had submitted to the United Nations. But we had also reached out to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon at the time, who was traveling to Cameroon to meet with President Biya. And President Biya, who's been president of Cameroon now for more than three decades, is a very elusive figure. And quite honestly, as we understand it, spends very little time in Cameroon. He spends about half his year in Geneva. What his fondness is for Geneva, no one's quite certain about. But what we are certain about is he runs up quite a high tab there. But in that case, we were able to get information to Ban Ki-moon while he was on his way to Cameroon, and he met with President Biya and raised Louis Mejio's case and raised the case of another individual singer who we were working on at the time. And Louis Mejio was released, and he had thousands and thousands of dollars in medical bills because of his poor health at the time. And in 6 months after his release, I got a package in the mail, and it was a copy of his newspaper, which I think brought a tear to everyone's eye in the office because it was truly an illustration of where our work is at its best. Unfortunately, in the last few months, he's been accused of defamation again. And is back in custody, currently serving. He was given, I think it was a 3-year sentence with a minimum of 6 months if he pays a fairly ridiculous sum of money in fines.
Do you find that most African governments respond that quickly when you involve, I guess, someone like Ban Ki-moon?
I would say no. I mean, it's hard to, I hate to generalize across a continent, and they are a very different, unlike, say, the former Soviet Union, where I think you have very, very, very clear trends and patterns across countries, and there's a lot of clear collusion that goes on there. In the African continent, it's different, and it is collusion by region for sure as well. But in a number of countries, you get tactics that we like to call catch and release. So Zimbabwe very rarely will arrest somebody and hold on to them for long periods of time. They'll generally hold them, abuse them, torture them, basically put the fear of God into them, and then release them within a few months. And that's generally their tactic, and we see that in a number of countries. In other countries like Cameroon, and in particular Ethiopia, they hold on to prisoners long term. And in a country like Ethiopia, it's particularly interesting because that country has a fairly strong relationship with U.S. government. We give a lot of money, particularly via USAID, to that country. The U.S. government, certainly under President Obama, called for the release of political prisoners in Ethiopia repeatedly, was even in Addis, called for release of political prisoners. And frankly, that was the only thing that actually resulted in the release of some very young guys who had really just been Facebook activists. That was all they were doing. They were not particularly politically motivated. I think they were talking about planning street protests. But frankly, all they were doing was putting posts on Facebook critical of the government. And they were put in prison, and they were there for more than a year pending trial. The trial was dragged out, and President Obama was headed over to Addis for the African Union, and he frankly put their names on a list and said, I won't come to Ethiopia, and I certainly won't meet with Prime Minister if they're not released. And they were. But in most cases, we see it's where you have a humanitarian argument to be made. So in Louis Mejio's case, the humanitarian argument was he was in such poor, poor shape and was really in desperate need of medical treatment that he was not able to get in prison. That's the argument that seems to really get you somewhere with a number of African countries. Unfortunately, in Ethiopia, it's been a particularly tricky one because they are so politically well protected because of their relationships with the U.S. as well as the EU.
And you are currently working on a few prisoners of conscience in Ethiopia?
We are. So our work in Ethiopia goes back about 6 or 7 years. Our longest standing case is the case of a journalist named Iskender Niga, who was given an 18-year sentence on terrorism charges. Most of the political prisoners in prison in Ethiopia are there now under their anti-terror law, which has been widely condemned as vague and abusively applied. The government of Ethiopia's response is it's the same as the British law, because in fact they did pretty much just copy the British anti-terror law. The difference is the Ethiopian anti-terror law is about 8 pages, 16 with English and Amharic. The English anti-terror law is hundreds of pages and includes all sorts of definitions and the like. But the more important distinction is how it's used. And in Ethiopia, it's applied roundly against journalists. And Iskender Nega is still in prison. And some others who were more aptly described as political activists who were associated with him are also still in prison. And Iskender's wife, in fact, actually lives here in the Washington, D.C. area now.
Just generally speaking, when someone is detained like that, what is the domino effect? And because, of course, you know it's affecting that person and their family. And then how does it affect the community?
Well, that's a great question, and it's very hard to quantify that. But I think what we can quantify and what we can see, particularly policy analysts that are stepping back and looking for that, and we, to the extent we have capacity at Freedom Now, try to do some of that analysis ourselves. But I think there's no doubt that it has a chilling effect on the community when someone is arrested. And in the early days, when they tend to really just go after activists that are particularly vocal, particularly outspoken, bringing people to the streets, because that's something that truly scares governments. For example, in Iskender Nega's case, the journalist in Ethiopia, what he did was write an article talking, this was just in the days after the Arab Spring began, and he wrote an article talking about how perhaps the Arab Spring might spring in Ethiopia, and that terrified them. So those sorts of people are usually the first targeted if you look at crackdown waves. And then following that, they become more and more emboldened, particularly as they realize there don't seem to be any consequences for holding on to these political prisoners, or not consequences that outweigh the benefits to getting them away and silenced. Then you start to see them going for others, like, for example, people who just put comments on Facebook. And we're seeing that more and more, as well as lawyers. They start to put in prison the lawyers who are just defending these activists. And that's always a very worrying trend. So when you see that, for example, in Tajikistan, where they've really imprisoned, they've essentially disbarred or imprisoned most of the criminal defense attorneys who were taking any politically sensitive cases. So the result has now been that any of the other lawyers don't want to take on these cases. They're terrified they're either going to be put in prison or they're going to be disbarred and they don't have any income. So there's no doubt the journalists stop being so critical, the lawyers stop taking politically sensitive cases, and all you really get are the most kind of vehement vocal types, and they usually get swept up and imprisoned pretty early.
I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier, and that was the arrest based on terrorism charges. So I noticed there's a few of the prisoners on your website that are accused of terrorism. So how does Freedom Now distinguish between who actually is, because terrorism is one of those hot-button words, that this is like a catch-all phrase. Mm. In what circumstances is it being abused, and how would Freedom Now distinguish between somebody who actually is a potential terrorist and somebody who is just being set up on these charges?
Well, we look very closely at the individual and their background and the types of work they were doing, as well as the law itself that's applied against them and the way that the trial was conducted. So it's really those pieces and the information that we obtain to those questions that then give us what we need to make a determination that someone's a prisoner of conscience, which is a determination we make internally. Now, while if Amnesty International, which of course coined that term, declares someone a prisoner of conscience, it gives us a lot of comfort in coming to that same conclusion. But we still do that analysis, and we work with outside lawyers, pro bono lawyers at law firms to help us make that designation. But you ask a very important question, because in some cases, some countries make it easy for us, where even if they're using things like national security laws, like, for example, in Vietnam, they use these very, very vague national security laws. And even in Ethiopia, frankly, if you look at the indictments of people under terrorism charge, you know, it will just be this circular, they're accused of terrorism because they engaged in terrorism or they supported terrorism. There's no fact-based analysis. There's no inclusion of any facts. And at trial, so actually, just to take a step back and give you the case of Liu Xiaobo, who was the Nobel Peace Prize laureate in China, who just passed away from liver cancer recently, he was accused of inciting subversion. Well, if you look at what was produced at trial as evidence against him, it was his writings It was his writings calling for the government to respect human rights. Liu Xiaobo actually never even called for regime change, which is something that a number of other dissidents were doing. So he wasn't even calling for the change in the government. He was calling for peaceful respect of the human rights of people. So in that instance, it's fairly easy in those cases where you look at what's used as evidence against them at trial and it's their peaceful writings. In other cases, it can be trickier, particularly, for example, in the former Soviet Union, because the tactic they've generally always used is fabricated charges. So it's drug charges, it's hooliganism, it's extortion, it's bribery, it's tax evasion. In recent years, they've all gotten very enthusiastic about financial crimes because they're much more complex. And we don't shy away from those because, of course, we did, then those countries would realize this is a, you know, we're going to continue to pursue this particular method. So we have to look very, very closely at the law. And terrorism has become now, as you just pointed out, a catch-all, because even in the former Soviet Union, where they were particularly excited about using fabricated charges, in recent years, they too are using anti-terror laws, because it is one of those things that makes everybody who looks at a case take a step back. Because this is a global issue, and this is something that affects most of the world, and you have to take seriously. But it's still the same analysis that we do. We look at the law. How vague is the law? Who are they applying it to? So to go back to the example of Ethiopia, it's an incredibly vague law. They're applying it against journalists. These are people who've worked for years and years and years as journalists. To go back to the Soviet Union, you'll have a case of someone who's been a human rights defender and a journalist working with large NGOs like Human Rights Watch or Amnesty International, and then they're all of a sudden accused of drug trafficking or terrorism. It just doesn't pass that sniff test. And so at that point, we then look more closely at what they're doing at trial. Are they respecting trial rights? Is the defense able to actually put on a defense? And when you take all that together, we feel fairly confident to come to the conclusion that someone's being arbitrarily detained.
We'll get back to that in just a moment, but a reminder that you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Maren Turner, Executive Director of Freedom Now, a U.S.-based nonprofit, nonpartisan group working to free individual prisoners of conscience. I'm Rebecca Ward, along with Kim Lewis, and reminding you that our PC USA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. And here's a shout out to Ali Faris in Iran. Thanks for checking out our Facebook page. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. We'd also like to know what you think of VOA's Press Conference USA and would appreciate it if you took our brief online survey at the Facebook page. Well, let me get back to the terrorism charges. I guess my next question would be simply that, is this something fairly new that is open to abuse?
The use of terrorism charges?
That other countries, perhaps more, you know, westernized countries, would not take such an interest in a prisoner of conscience that they would, say, for someone like Aung San Suu Kyi, who is a democracy activist.
I think they still take these seriously because I think governments like the U.S. And EU countries take very seriously allegations made by international organizations and civil society. So certainly where a case crosses their desk and a person's been accused of terrorism, they might be reluctant, and they absolutely would be reluctant to speak out too soon before they're able to acquire more information. But once they get the information they need from international organizations like mine, Freedom Now, and others, and we're able to make them comfortable with the fact that this is really just a fabrication, then we have not. I mean, we have found governments like the U.S. and European countries to be perfectly happy to speak out about these cases. A good example is Iskender Niga in Ethiopia. So happily, I can say we've not found that to be the case. But the flip side of that is it's just a lot more work for us, you know, and for organizations like mine. One of the key avenues that we pursue is providing legal representation. So we're taking their cases to international bodies and courts. And we've always found that critical, even where the charges themselves or the person is quite well known, like Aung San Suu Kyi. It's clear she was a political prisoner. But having an independent opinion from an international court or body is helpful for no other reason than when you have government officials in the U.S. or European countries or other countries. I don't mean to just use them as the example. When they raise the cases, you can imagine it's a lot easier for them if they're able to say, why haven't you complied with your international treaty obligations? Here's an opinion from the UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention calling for so-and-so's release, as opposed to, we decided we think this person's a political prisoner and you should release them. In cases now where governments use charges that and laws that certainly the Western countries also have and are going to look at much more with much more scrutiny, it just means it's a lot more work for us in making the legal case. And in some cases, we might really be prevented from doing a whole lot of advocacy until we get a decision from an international body or court, because those officials might not be comfortable until you have that independent decision.
Also, just recently, as of yesterday, going back to the African continent, looking at South Africa, President Jacob Zuma just yesterday escaped, I guess you can say, a no-confidence vote. You know, he's an embattled president who there has one scandal after another. So because of this, do you find that people are freer And even journalists or human rights activists, do you find that they are freer in their expression of him, or do they still have the same kind of fears as other people do in other countries that have more of restrictive freedom of speech?
I mean, to be clear, I haven't worked in or focused on South Africa for a number of years, but having lived there and having worked there, I certainly maintain an interest and so follow the news. And I can say from the work that we do, cases have not come to us from South Africa. And in that respect, there's no question there's much greater freedom in South Africa as compared to other countries in Africa. That said, particularly under Jacob Zuma, there's been a lot there. There's I think observers have noted a number of ways in which the country is not abiding by its international obligations with respect to human rights. There's a number of very worrying trends. And I have read reports that the ANC and Jacob Zuma have been successful in really chilling a lot of criticism against them, because most of the country is still supportive of ANC, even if they're critical. So the country is certainly one to watch. And is concerning, right? Because it really is the beacon of democracy in Africa. So it's, and for me, very unsettling just having lived there at a time where there was, you know, there was a number of things going on that were also worrying, but not like today. But I can tell you, just based on my work and what I'm observing, it's certainly nowhere near what we're seeing in other countries. I was surprised, though, to see that Jacob Zuma had survived the no confidence vote, particularly given that it was taken in secrecy and my understanding just the criticism against him. But frankly, I lived there when he was campaigning, and I was surprised that he got the presidency in the first place, given that he had already survived trials for corruption and rape. Yes. So he seemed to me unelectable. But there's other places where people who I thought were unelectable became president. So
why don't we stay in that region and talk about Zimbabwe? Because there, what I notice is that you don't really have anything about Zimbabwe right next door. Mm. But yet there, we know that there's quite a bit of corruption and arrest of dissidents.
Sure. Well, we worked on a case in Zimbabwe a few years ago of about, I want to say it was about 45 political activists that were rounded up. But mainly the reason that we don't work on Zimbabwe is they just don't hold on to people for very long. So they make a lot of arrests, and there's a lot of headlines related to the arrests. But they don't arrest them under charges like anti-terrorism charges or the like, and then hold on to them for years. It's very rare that you'll see a political activist held for more than a couple of months. So with the work that we do, since a big component of it is working on the legal case, filing the legal case abroad, we're not as best placed to work on those sorts of cases. An organization like Amnesty International, or a regional organization that's much more just kind of advocacy and just trying to get information out there about it, is much more well placed. So that's the reason why you don't see much Zimbabwe on our website.
You do have a few from Iran. That's a place where they do hold them for a while.
It is a place where they do hold them for a while.
Including Americans.
Iran and China are the two countries combined that have the world's highest population of political prisoners. And Iran arrests all sorts. It's not just political activists. They cast a very, very wide net And of course, they're particularly well known for going after the LGBT community and the like. So, and they put people to death in that country as well. But in recent years, dual passport holders, both here in the U.S., as you said, we work on the case of father and son, the Namazis, who are American-Iranian businessmen who went over there and were accused of essentially, you know, espionage on behalf of the American government. In the U.K. as well, there's cases of British nationals who are dual passport holders who are also in prison in Iran. And those governments have, particularly the U.K., has come out publicly about just how hamstrung it feels that it is in trying to bring about the release of their own citizens. And as we've seen, the Trump administration has been vocal on the Namazi's case, both before they, before he became president and after. And they're still holding them.
So what can a country do? I mean, do they enlist your help and Amnesty International and other NGOs to, I guess, put pressure on these countries?
From our perspective, it's purely a matter of you're holding these people. They're being arbitrarily detained. There's no doubt they're political prisoners. You should release them. And as far as the way that we bring about pressure, it's really a matter of just looking at each individual case and looking at points of leverage. And looking at the friendlies as well. When we work on cases, for example, in Cuba, quite a few years ago, we worked on a case. And it wasn't a case where we were really trying to line up allies in Washington, D.C., because any advocacy coming from Washington, D.C. was fairly dead on arrival in Havana. So in that respect, we looked to engage officials in the Spanish government and actually Venezuela, which might surprise you at the time, as well as the Vatican. So we looked to make use of friendly relationships, but also leverage. Like, for example, in the U.S., where, you know, I brought up Ethiopia and the fact there's a really there's strong collaboration on anti-terror initiatives. And there's a lot of funds aimed for at development that are given by the U.S. government to Ethiopia. So these sorts of things we look at to try to utilize in terms of mobilizing allies to speak out about the case, because it's really about trying to bring as many influential people and institutions into the issue and to speak out about the case and to sit down with the detaining government and raise the person's situation.
Is there one particular case that is really weighing on Freedom Now or a big push that they're having a lot of struggle with?
Well, I'll say that all cases...
So many? Yes.
All cases weigh on our mind. I would say for me personally, at the moment, the one I've been most engaged on is a case from Azerbaijan of a journalist who fled Azerbaijan a couple of years ago and went to live in Georgia, which is a country just next door, where a lot of the Azerbaijani exiles are living, fleeing persecution in the country. And in May, at the very, very end of May, this individual named Afghan Mirtali was kidnapped off the streets in the capital of Georgia and taken to Azerbaijan across the border and resurfaced the following day in custody, in police custody in Baku, and was charged with illegally crossing the border, having 10,000 euros in his pocket and resisting arrest. When in fact, there's plenty of evidence that supports his story, which is I had just gotten off of a bus, gone into a convenience store and was on my way home when I got picked up. And he was picked up by Georgian police and then handed off to Azerbaijani police. So this is something that's really shocked the human rights community in that part of the world. Georgia has a very different reputation from Azerbaijan. Azerbaijan is a notable authoritarian government with a presidency that's just come from a lineage straight from the Soviet Union times. Georgia is a democracy that had a democratic, peaceful democratic revolution in 2003 and is a strong ally and partner of the United States. And so this development is something that's really affected us, because it's not just a matter of a case of another person being persecuted. It's that you have collusion at whatever level, potentially just security services level. That's what I'd like to assume, certainly not higher than that, with a democratic country to take someone into custody who is a political prisoner.
Well, thank you so much, Maren Turner. My director is a motioning that we are out of time. I appreciate you being with us. Maren Turner is Executive Director of Freedom Now, a U.S.-based nonprofit, nonpartisan group working to free individual prisoners of conscience. Thank you, of course, to my colleague Kim Lewis. You can hear her daily on English to Africa broadcast called Africa News Tonight. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Our engineer was Thomas Blondet. And I'm Rebecca Ward. Join me again next week, or rather, join Carol Castiel next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.